Call your attention tonight to James chapter 3. James chapter 3. We began last week the message, The Taming of the Tongue. The Taming of the Tongue. I only made it through part of point number 2. I began with verse 1, and the first point in the first four verses, 1 through 4, was that direction can be found with the tongue. It gives a couple of examples. They're metaphors that I want you to basically commit to memory. I'll ask you to maybe think about that again at the end of the message tonight. But I want you to think about the two metaphors that are in the first four verses, the picture. Metaphor is just simply a fancy word which means a picture. There's a bit that is put in horses' mouths, and I talked about that horse that I got on. He talked about the helm there in verse number 4, which is another word for rudder. And when I got home last week, I began to think about a story that I wanted to share and just did not. But basically, it's the story of something that fascinated me as a child. How many of you remember the story of the German ship called the Bismarck? All right, many, many of you older people do. Well, you younger folks, what you ought to do is you ought to do a search on the Bismarck. Or if you've got one of these smart TVs that you have your Wi-Fi hooked up to and you have YouTube available, YouTube the German warship, the Bismarck. And you'll be just amazed at this story. The Bismarck was the biggest ship in the German army. Matter of fact, it was the biggest ship in the world when it came to warring. And of course, the U-boats were just wreaking havoc across the Atlantic. Well, there were two ocean liners. One of them was the Queen Mary, and I'm forgetting what the other one's name was. Queen Elizabeth, I think. And these luxury liners had been, I guess, commandeered by the government to transport people back and forth across the Atlantic because of their speed. The U-boats could not catch those ocean liners because of the speed. But when the Bismarck was launched, the Bismarck was faster, which meant that the Bismarck could sink any boat in the world. The guns were bigger, they would shoot farther, they would have other ships in range before they would be in range. The British intelligence told about the Bismarck being launched. The British government with Churchill, they dispatched a couple of boats. One of them was the Hood. And they said, you've got to go try to sink the Bismarck. And there was a song when I was just a little boy about sinking the Bismarck. I think a guy named Johnny Horton may have sung it. Well, the Hood and the Prince of Wales maybe were the two boats. And they had basically gone to fight the Bismarck because one-on-one, nothing would have been even close to of a challenge. Well, immediately the Hood was sunk. I mean, it went down fast. And the Prince of Wales was disabled, and it was able to get away before it was sunk. Well, immediately, of course, the Germans are like, nobody can stop us now. I mean, we just took out the biggest ship that the Brits had, the Hood. Everything else is now going to be running scared because they don't have the firepower. Well, they marshaled everything that they could in Britain, and one of the things that they did was they got an old aircraft carrier, and it had a, I think it was called a swordfish airplane. And it would be an airplane that would just carry a torpedo. And they were trying to do anything that they could to stop Bismarck. Well, the way that the story has been told to me is that they found the Bismarck, and this Swordfish plane kind of came in from behind and dropped the torpedo, and it was headed right toward the stern of Bismarck. They could see the wave coming with the torpedo, and the captain of the Bismarck tried to swerve to get out of the way, but the torpedo hit and damaged the rudder, which meant that they could not steer it right nor left. It could only go straight. Well, immediately what that did was that disabled her, and she was trying to get to France, because you remember the Germans had taken France. Well, as she was headed toward France, she was only just a few hours away from friendly waters where that those submarines, the U-boats, could have protected her. But they were able to have five British vessels that were able to get to where she was headed, and they lined up. The King George V, or the Five, began to fire. And finally, it was damaged so much that it finally was sunk. They sunk the Bismarck. And it was all because of a rudder that got damaged. The tongue is like that rudder. And so that was our first point last week. It can give direction. The second thing that we got into was in verse 5 through 8, which was the destruction that can be caused by the tongue. And I talked about how that bookstores in London had been just basically ravaged during World War II. Over 1 million volumes of various rare books had been destroyed because of the incendiary bombs that had been dropped. And then we talked about how the Great Chicago Fire started. And that was another metaphor that was here in our passage. That's found in verse 5 and 6. And then in verse 8, it talks about it being a poison. And so I want us to look at verse 5 so that we can kind of get back up to speed tonight. And we will try to finish the 12 verses that we began last week. Look at verse 5. Even so, the tongue is a little member. It's not big like a bicep, not big like a thigh or a calf, not big like a foot maybe, but it's a little member, and it boasteth great things though. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. I mean, a fire can get out of hand very, very quickly. I remember when I was about, I could not have been more than 5 years old when this happened. Across the street, not a street, it's a road. Across the road at my grandparents' house, I mean, it was a sand dirt road. There was what was called the cotton house. It was an old, basically a barn, and that's where they would store cotton after they had picked it on the farm. And me and about four of my cousins were over there playing with matches. And we started a fire in that cotton house. And they ran. And I thought, they're going to kill us if this thing burns down. And I don't know how, but as a five-year-old kid, fire was probably, I don't know, big as this pulpit top. I was able to beat that thing out with something that I found. And nobody ever said anything, but I guarantee you, my grandfather was like, "These char marks on my cotton house floor." That thing could have very easily burned to the ground. You know why? Because we're playing with fire and it just about got away. And I've never forgiven my cousins for running. The tongue is a fire. It's a world of iniquity. It's a world of sin. And it makes our members, or it's one of our members, and it defiles the whole body. It makes the whole body dirty. And it sets on fire the course of nature, and it's set on fire of hell. And we talked about that hell being Gehenna. For every kind of beast and of the birds and of the serpents and of the things of the sea is tamed, and it hath been tamed of mankind, but the tongue no man can tame. It's an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. So the metaphors that we've seen thus far, a bit, a rudder, a fire, poison. All right? Those are the first four. Now, when I ask you to think about the trouble and the hurt and the harm that the tongue has caused, anybody here think about some Bible stories, things that happened in the scripture that the tongue caused great damage in these situations? Can anybody think of anything? And I'm asking for a response tonight. Anybody think? I've written down two or three of them myself. I want to see if you can think along with me with this. Anybody want to give it a wag tonight? Okay. All righty. Jacob and Esau. Okay. And how did the words that were said, how did that cause damage? That's ultimately what happened. So the lying tongue basically set two brothers and their families and ultimately their countries at odds with each other. Okay? All right? Anybody else? Okay? What about John the Baptist's story? You say, John the Baptist didn't say anything wrong. No, he didn't. But what about the guy that took his head off, Herod? He's got basically his stepdaughter, and she's dancing before Herod and his buddies. And she's getting these guys all bothered, and he calls her over and says, "Hey, I'll give you whatever you want because you have pleasured my friends and me. You have just danced here, and you've got us all, happy as we can be, just seeing you in this sensual way." And old Salome goes to her mother and says, "What do you want me to ask for? He's told me he'd give me anything up to half the kingdom, basically." And old Herodias said, "You tell him you want John the Baptist's head." See, the tongue got Herod in trouble. He did not want to kill John. But because he had publicly made that announcement with his mouth, he had to follow through on it. And the last of the Old Testament prophets had his head cut off because of a promise that was made with a wicked mouth. What about the story of Jesus? You think about what happened during the crucifixion. Did they not call witnesses in and say, lie about him? And those witnesses, for the sake of money, they said, "We heard him blaspheme God." What about the soldiers and their mocking? Can our lips and our tongue, can we not mock and cause great damage? Tell us who hit you if you're the Son of God. What about the scribes and the chief priest? "Hey, you saved others, save yourself," as he's hanging there on the cross. Are those things not harmful and hurtful? Our tongue is a fire. It's a deadly poison. I came across a guy that had basically taken all of the different verses in the Bible about gossip, and I forgot to write the man's name down. It was something like Paul Taugue or something like that. It's like Taugue, I believe. And basically he gave him the titles, and I loved it the way that he titled these things, because every one of us will say, I've done that, or I know somebody that's doing that. Every one of us will know one of these five. The first type that he described is the spy. The spy. Well, what are they? They peddle secrets. They'll slip up next to you and, well, I don't want you to tell anybody else. But let me just tell you what's going on. And basically, they peddle nonsense. When I think about that, I mean, I can think about all kind of things in politics where somebody will drop a little hint to maybe a news reporter. And the next thing you know, you have all kind of things like a fake dossier. If you're not familiar with what's going on, just turn on your television. You've got people that peddle in secrets, but you know what? You've got some of God's people that want to peddle in secrets. I had somebody say something one time to me, and they said, well, I'm sure you know about this. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't. And they're like, but you're the preacher. You should have heard this a long time ago. I said, let me tell you something. You'd be surprised. Sometimes the preacher's the last one to know what's going on. You know? And so the first person that you got the spy. Are you a peddler of secrets? I hope not. Well, number two, you've got the grumbler. These are the people that whisper and murmur. They just whisper and murmur. That's pretty destructive. As a matter of fact, one of the great stories in the book of Numbers has to do with people that were murmurers and grumblers. And what did God do? God sent serpents among them. He was like, you know what? I'm tired of their griping. I'm tired of them grumbling about this and grumbling about that. And then finally, God said, enough. And all of a sudden, every time they'd reach into a bag, there'd be a snake there. And finally, the only way that they could get any type of cure was for there to be a brazen serpent that was lifted up on a pole. And I preached on that a couple of months ago. And so you've got the grumbler. Well, the third type of gossip you got, this is the backstabber. The backstabber. This is the one that they basically have vengeance in their heart. I'll get them back. And they want to do their best to inflict pain on the person that they're talking about. I mean, they just want to see them hurt and hurt bad. And so they stab them in the back. And sometimes it can even be friends when friends do it. The fourth kind is the chameleon. Now, what is a chameleon? Well, a chameleon is a little critter that just kind of blends in. I mean, you've got to kind of look hard because sometimes he can be brown, sometimes he can be green, sometimes he can be a little of both. And he sits there just still, doesn't make any noise. Sometimes he even shut his eyes where that they wouldn't be able to see those little eyeballs. And he's quiet as he can be, but he just kind of blends in. This is the person that is in a group. And this group is just savaging somebody. And they're there and they're just as quiet and they may be shaking their head like, I agree. And so you've got the chameleon. They don't really, you know, lead the conversation. Oh, but make no mistake about it, they're a part of it. And then the fifth type is the busybody. Their excitement comes by knowing everybody else's business. I mean, it's amazing to me. We've got senior ladies in this church that come one or two Sundays a month and they know more about what's going on than the deacons do. You know, I mean, it's amazing what some of these folks know. They'll say, Preacher, did you hear about this? No. Well, you want to know? Well, I mean, is it going to hurt or harm the church? I mean, if it's going to hurt it, I certainly want to know it so we can stop it. But you've got the busybody. I mean, they just want to know everybody else's business. I humorously joked many years ago, I said, what we need to do is we need to take that great theologian from the 50s and 60s, Hank Williams, and pay attention to what he says when he sang that song, Mind Your Own Business. There's some things that you and I just don't need to know about other people. There's no benefit to it. You know, it doesn't matter to me about a lot of things that you do. It's none of my business. Now, if you're being immoral, if you're harming the name of the church, if you're harming the name of the Lord, then yeah, we're going to have to deal with that. But there's some things that I just don't need to know. And there's things that you don't need to know about other people. That's one of the reasons that I don't really get on Facebook. I don't care when you go to Kroger. It doesn't matter to me, you know, if you got a hangnail. Now, if you got something bad, then let us know. You know, but it doesn't matter about a lot of stuff. If you're going to share stuff, make it something that is important. I don't want to have a church full of busybodies where they know everybody's business instead of just saying, I got a job to do. I want to just serve the Lord. And so those are the five things that Paul Tagu had basically given. And so you've got those third and fourth metaphors. Well, that brings me to point number three. I want you to look with me at verse 9. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men. And these men are made in the similitude or the likeness of God. So think about that. You've got people, and on Sundays, hallelujah, praise God. God is so good. And I mean, they're just lifting up the name of the Lord with everything they've got. I mean, they are just in it for the Lord on Sunday. Monday, what are they doing? They're cursing everybody around them. What the blankety blank thing's wrong with you? You know, you're about as stupid or whatever, and this go on to some big diatribe. And yet, out of the same mouth, both of those things happen. You and I ought not be that way. Your speech on Monday ought to be the way that it was on Sunday. The way that you speak to your wife and kids ought to be the way that you speak to the preacher. The way that you treat your friends ought to be the way that you treat people that you meet at the grocery store and the way that you speak. We ought not bless God in one breath and then curse men who were made in the likeness of God in the next. And so if we were going to give a title to the point number three, it would be that delight can be produced by the tongue. Out of the same mouth, verse 10, proceedeth blessings and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be. They should not happen that way. And then, what do we have? We've got another metaphor. Verse 11. Doth a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? And the word bitter there is the same word in verse 12 for salt. So what you've got is you've got sweet water, salt water. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not a real fan of swallowing salt water. When I've been to the beach, and I've got salt water in my mouth, the last thing I want to do is swallow it. I would much rather have good, clean, fresh water. And yet, you've got the picture of a fountain. When you have water that comes from a source, it can be a blessing or it can be a curse. There's a story over in 2 Kings 2. And basically what the story is there's a place called Jericho. Same Jericho that's there today. Matter of fact, some people claim that Jericho is the oldest city in the Middle East. It's called the City of Palm Trees. And so, the story is during the time of Elijah. And the water is bitter there. So what does he do? He does a miracle. He takes some salt and he pours it there. And next thing you know, they've got great fresh water. And the scripture says, until this day. And I tried to find out how Jericho's water ranks in the world today. And I could not find that out. But I'm curious if it was unto this day when the book of Kings was finished, or if it's unto this day in which we live. That'd be something that I'd be interested in. But I can tell you this about Jericho, as a lot of people live there now. And most of them are Arabs. Jericho is mainly an Arab city now, more so than a Jewish place. But Jericho had a problem with water, and the prophet of God was able to do a miracle and bless those people with that miracle. The tongue that you have in your mouth, you have the ability to bless people, or you got the ability to make it bitter. It just all depends on what's in your heart. Because out of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so, we can do good or bad. Verse 12 says, "Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries?" Now, I did not see any fig trees when I was there in Israel. But I saw olive trees. And the olive trees that we saw at the time that we were there, they were not ripe. Let me just say as a way of warning to you. If you ever take a trip to Israel, don't eat an olive berry that's not ripe. How many of you have ever eaten a persimmon? I mean, it'll make your lips pucker. Well, olive berries are exactly that way when they're not ripe. We were walking through a little village that had been constructed to show how it was in biblical times. I mean, they literally had sheep, and they had a lady that was doing a loom, and she had a little spinner there, and she was spinning the wool into strings, and then they were weaving them together with the loom and with the shuttle and all of that stuff. And it was all basically hand operated. And as we were going through that, they had some looked like croaker sacks that were on the ground, and the berries would fall off of the tree, and they have little rakes that they literally rake leaves with. So I reached up and got one of those green things. I popped it in my mouth, and immediately it was like, I'm trying to spit it out. That lasted in my mouth, I know, for 20 minutes. I mean, I'm getting bottled water, and all it's doing is just tightening it up. I'm thinking, as tight as this has made my mouth, somebody needs to put this in a lotion and let people with wrinkles use it. I mean, that could be just a natural ingredient here. I mean, it could take somebody with wrinkles and poof, they got 20-year-old skin. But I mean, that stuff just puckered my lips. And my tongue, it had a, you know, had kind of a, it was almost like it had been burned. Our mouths have the ability to be bitter like that. But also, there's a fig tree that's there. And so we've got the picture of the fountain, number five picture, five metaphor, and then six is the fig tree. Now I'm going to tell you, I love fig trees. That is the one tree that I have never planted at my house. Now I've planted some plum trees before. Then they got some kind of disease and I pulled them up. I've planted some apple trees and they never really did that well. I'm not much of a fruit tree guy, evidently, as far as raising stuff. But I have always loved people that had fig trees. I remember years ago, I got Brother James to help me with this. I had gone over somewhere and a guy had an old, like a 94 Ranger truck, and he couldn't get the thing started. And he said, I'll sell it to you for what I got, you know, in it from the last shop trip to the shop. They couldn't fix it. And I think I bought that truck for like $400. I said, you want a check or you want cash? And he goes, well, cash is always better. So I just happened to have it on me that day. And so I gave him $400. He gave me the title. Well, it wouldn't crank. So I got Brother James to take his big triple axle trailer over. And we got that thing up on that trailer. Well, that old man had a couple of big fig trees in his backyard. And those figs had ripened. And he said, won't you try one of these? And I put that thing in my mouth. And I'm telling you, that was one of the greatest things that I have ever tasted, was that fig tree fig. I never forgot how great that was, and I've wanted to plant those things in my yard, and I just hadn't found a place where I want to put it. Fig trees are a wonderful thing. And olive trees can be wonderful, but don't eat them green. But you don't have a fig tree that produces olives. Just like you don't have a cotton plant or a cotton seed that'll produce corn. They're different. If our hearts are true, there ought to be good things that come out. If our hearts are not, then all of a sudden there'll be bitterness. There'll be hatred. There'll be things that do not bless, but there'll be things that will destroy. I want us to be a church that loves each other so much that we can't wait to build one another. Instead of glorying and finding out that we have got somebody that's maybe fallen into a sin, or we found somebody that didn't fall into it, they just jumped into it. We don't relish in that. We literally weep over that. That we care about one another so much that we don't try to take them down, we try to restore them. And I hope that that will be the attitude that we've got. Now, I mentioned last week that there are some special words that we ought to all learn and we ought to use them often. You say, well, what are those special words? Well, we're really good at telling our kids to say please. We've got a 2-year-old granddaughter, and we're trying to teach her how to basically learn manners. If you're eating something, she wants it. It don't matter what it is, she wants it. And they've got her on non-dairy stuff. And so if they're not around, I'll give her some ice cream. I was eating some ice cream the other night, and she goes, bite, bite. And I said, please? She goes, please? So I'd get a little bit and I'd give it to her, look around, make sure nobody was there. That kid sat there 5 minutes, me and Isabella, Papa and granddaughter, just eating a little ice cream she wasn't supposed to have. Matter of fact, I probably wasn't supposed to have any either. So we were just having fun together. But she says, please. Isn't it a wonderful thing when somebody is polite with their tongue and they go, would you like that? Well, yes, I would. Or would you please give this to me? Instead of saying, give it to me. What's another word? Thank you. Thank you. I heard a funny, funny story my first year of Bible college. I was at Bob Jones University, and I was listening to Dr. Bob Jones III preach. And he had been somewhere, and he said, I was walking into to a shopping center and to a particular store, and he said, I noticed that there was a lady that was kind of uppity walking, and she had this little dog. You know, it seems like that, you know, the richer the woman, the smaller the dog. She got this little dog, and she's just walking, doesn't have a smile on her face or anything, and he sees her coming, so he just stands there, and then he opens the door for her, and she walks by just like you're supposed to do that. And this is what he said to her. This is what he told the chapel. He said, so basically when she walked by and she didn't say anything, he said, you're welcome and so is your kid. I never forgot that story. Because there are times when I have waited for people to come in behind me to hold the door. And I always want to be polite to them. But I always like it when they say thank you. And so when somebody does that for me, I'm constantly reminded, you acknowledge their generosity. Say thank you. What about I'm so sorry? Do you have too much pride to say you're sorry? Well, I'm going to tell you, if you live long enough, you're going to have to eat those words every once in a while. Because you are going to do something that you wish you wouldn't have done. It could be that you say something to your wife that you shouldn't say. It may be that you bark at your husband one day when he does something that you don't like. And you know the moment you say it, because the Spirit of God smites your heart, boy, I shouldn't have said that. Maybe it's somebody in the church, and you say something harsh to them, and you go, you know, that just didn't come out right. Are you willing to put that pride aside and say, you know, I am so sorry that I said that. Would you please forgive me? What about I love you? You know, that's something, it seems like the older I get, it's easier for me to say. You know, maybe when you're 35 years old, you know, you kind of, you know, well, if I say that, you know, somebody will think I'm soft. But it seems like that I've gotten some age on me now. It seems like that I can say it a lot easier. As a matter of fact, there are times if I text people in the church, you know, if it's a lady, I always say in the Lord. But I'll say something about thank you for your faithfulness, and Deb and I love you in the Lord, or something like that. I want people to know that I love them. The book of 1 John says that we're supposed to love the brethren. The Gospel of John says that all men will know that we are brothers by the love that we have one for another. Can I tell you something? The people in this church are closer to me than many of my own family. And it's because we have more in common. Sure, we have blood with our natural families. But sometimes those people that are Christians, those relationships can transcend that blood because of the Spirit of God that lives inside of those believers. And so we ought to say, I love you. And then, what about this? I'm praying for you. Is that not a building phrase? If somebody's praying for you, that means they're for you. They're for you. I'm praying for you. A couple of years ago, there was a few Sundays whenever I would go and I would represent BIA at a church somewhere and basically trying to drum up students. And I would always say, I want you to pray for us, but I really want you to pray for me. There were times recent as probably last week, I was talking to somebody that was not a member of the church, and they were like, well, how are things going? I said, well, as far as I know, things are going good. I said, of course, it could be the preacher's last one to know, but I said, as far as I know, Spirit's great. You know, we're having just great services. I mean, our people are being blessed, and we're having a few people come. And I said, I think things are going well. And they said, well, I just wanted you to know that I've been praying for you. And I said, I appreciate that. Hey, pass the word. Brother Tom needs prayer. I like it when people pray for me. And I like it when people know that I'm praying for them. Because if you are going before God on behalf of somebody else, you're doing what Jesus is doing when he intercedes. Our tongue can be a blessing or it can be a cursing. Now, can you think, now don't ask, I'm not asking you to respond to this. I want you to respond in your own mind in this. Can you think of times when people have said things against or about you when your spirit was crushed? Can you think about that? Oh, I can think of times when things like that have happened. There's some people that have had things happen, and 30 years later, they still are holding that grudge. Can I tell you something? We're probably just as guilty of doing that as what's happened to us. So we ought to offer forgiveness. So can you think of a time when somebody has basically just crushed your spirit with their words? Can you think of a time when you have crushed somebody else with your words? And then I want you to try to remember the six things. Because every one of those things relate to how our tongue can be used. It can be used in a good way if there's a bit that's put in our mouth and we don't let bad things come out of our mouth. It can be used in a good way if that rudder is keeping things going in the right direction. It can be used in a horrible way if we let our tongue set on fire of hell the surroundings that are things that are surrounding us. The tongue can be a destructive thing if it's like a poison that we take in and all of a sudden there's all kind of problems that come from the poison. Or we can look at it and we can say, well, what about that fountain? Is my fountain that's coming forth out of my heart, is that sweetness or is it salty bitterness? Or the last thing, are you a fig tree that's doing something sweet? Because if you're a fig tree, you don't bear bitter berries. There's a sweetness there. The taming of the tongue. It's a hard thing. I mean, about the time you think you've got it whipped, you blow it. And then you got to go back to one of our phrases, I am so sorry. So I want us to have a church where our tongues are tamed. And I hope you do too. Let's stand together.